down the streets of Thwil to a ship that waited for him on the bright water in the morning. Chapter 5. The Dragon of Pendor. West of Roke, in a crowd between the two great lands, Husk and Ensmer, lie the 90 isles. The nearest to Roke is Surd, and the farthest is Sepish, which lies almost in the Pelish Sea. And whether the sum of them is 90 is a question never settled for. If you count only isles with freshwater springs, you might have 70, while if you count every rock, you might have 100 and still not be done. And then the tide would change, and narrow run the channels between the islets. And there the mild tides of the inmost sea, chafed and baffled, run high and fall low, so that where at high tide there might be 3 islands in one place, at low there might be 1. Yet for all that danger of the tide, every child who can walk can paddle, and has his little rowboat. Housewives row across the channel to take a cup of rush-wash tea with the neighbor. Peddlers call their wares in rhythm with the stroke of their oars. All roads there are salt water, blocked only by nets strung from house to house across the straits to catch the small fish called turbies, the oil of which is the wealth of the 90 isles. There are few bridges and no great towns. Every islet is thick with farms and fishermen's houses, and these are gathered into townships, each of 10 or 20 islets. And one such was Low Torning, the westernmost, looking not on the inmost sea, but outward to empty ocean, that lonely corner of the archipelago where only Pendor lies, the dragon-spoiled isle, and beyond it the waters of the West Reach, desolate. A house was ready there for the township's new wizard. Stood on a hill among green fields of barley, sheltered from the west wind by a grove of pendic trees that now were red with flowers, and from the door one looked out on other thatched roofs and groves and gardens and other islands with their roofs and fields and hills, and amongst them all the many bright winding channels of the sea. It was a poor house, windowless, with earthen floor, yet a better house than the one Ged was born in. The Islemen of Low Torning, standing in awe of the wizard from Roke, asked pardon for its humbleness. "We have no stone to build with," said one. "We are none of us rich, though none starve," said another. And a third, "It will be dry at least, for I saw to the thatching myself, sir." To get it was as good as any palace. He thanked the leaders of the township, frankly, so that the 18 of them went home, each in his own rowboat to his home isle, to tell the fishermen and housewives that the new wizard was a strange young grim fellow who spoke little, but he spoke fairly and without pride. There was little cause, perhaps, for pride in this first magistracy of Ged's. Wizards trained on Roke went commonly to cities or castles to serve high lords who held them in high honor. These fishermen of Low Torning in the usual way of things would have had among them no more than a witch or a plain sorcerer to charm the fishing nets and sing over new boats and cure beasts and men of their ailments. But in late years the old dragon of Pendor had spawned, and 9 dragons, it was said, now laired in the ruined towers of the sea lords of Pendor, dragging their scaled bellies up and down the marble stairs and through the broken doorways there, wanting food on that dead isle they would be flying forth some year when they were grown and hunger came upon them. Already a flight of 4 had been seen over the southwest shores of Husk, not alighting but spying out the sheepfolds, barns, and villages. The hunger of a dragon is slow to wake, but hard to sate. So the Islemen of Low Torning had sent to Roke, begging for a wizard to protect their folk from what boded over the western horizon, and the Archmage had judged their fear well-founded. "There's no comfort in this place," the Archmage had said to Ged on the day he made him wizard. "No fame, no wealth, maybe no risk. Will you go?"
"I will go," Ged had replied, not from obedience only.
Since the night on Roke Knoll, his desire had turned as much against fame and display as once it had been set on them. Always now he doubted his strength and dreaded the trial of his power. Yet also the talk of dragons drew him. Dragons from obedience only. Since the night on Roke Knoll, his desire had turned as much against fame and display as once it had been set on them. Always now he doubted his strength and dreaded the trial of his power. yet also the talk of dragons drew him with a great curiosity. In Gaunt there have been no dragons for many hundred years, and no dragon would ever fly within scent or sight or spell of Roke, so that there also they are a matter of tales and songs only, things sung of but not seen. Ged had learned all he could of dragons at the school, but it is one thing to read about dragons and another to meet them. The chance lay bright before him, and heartily he answered, "I will go." The Archmage Genscher had nodded, but his look was somber.
"Tell me," he said at last, "do you fear to leave Roke, or are you eager to be gone?"
"Both, my lord."
Again Genscher nodded.
"I do not know if I do right to send you from your safety here," he said very low. "I cannot see your way. It is all in darkness, and there is a power in the north, something that would destroy you, but what it is and where, whether in your past or on your forward way, I cannot tell. It is all shadowed, and when the men from Low Tarning came here, I thought at once of you, for it seemed a safe place and out of the way, where you might have time to gather your strength. But I do not know if any place is safe for you, or where your way goes. I do not want to send you out into the dark."
It seemed a bright enough place to get at first, the house under the flowering trees, and there he lived and watched the western sky often and kept his wizard's ear tuned for the sound of scaly wings, but no dragon came. And Ged fished from his jetty and tended his garden patch. He spent whole days pondering a page or a line or a word in the lore books he had brought from Roke, sitting out in the summer air under the Pendic trees while the Otak slept beside him, or went hunting mice in the forests of grass and daisies. And he served the people of Low Tarning as heal-all and weather-worker whenever they asked him. It did not enter his head that a wizard might be ashamed to perform such simple crafts, for he had been a witch-child among poorer folk than these. They, however, asked little of him, holding him in awe, partly because he was a wizard from the Isle of the Wise, and partly on account of his silence and his scarred face. There was that about him, young as he was, that made men uneasy with him. Yet he found a friend, a boatmaker, who dwelt on the next islet eastward. His name was Petchvari. They had met first on his jetty, where Ged stopped to watch him stepping the mast of a little catboat, and he had looked up at the wizard with a grin and said, "Here's a month's work nearly finished. I guess you might have done it in a minute with a word, eh, sir?"
"I might," said Ged, "but it would likely sink the next minute unless I kept the spell up. But if you like..." And he stopped.
"Well, sir?"
"Well, that is a lovely little craft. I mean, she needs nothing, but if you like, I could set a binding spell on her to help keep her sound, or a finding spell to help bring her home from the sea." He spoke hesitantly, not wanting to offend the craftsman, but Petchvari's face shone.
"The little boat's for my son, sir, and if you would lay such charms on her, it would be a mighty kindness and a friendly act."
And he climbed up onto the jetty to take Ged's hand then and there and thank him. And after that they came to work together often, Ged interweaving his spellcrafts with Petchvari's handwork on the boats he built or repaired, and in return learning from Petchvari how a boat was built, and also how a boat was handled without aid of magic. For this skill of plain sailing had been somewhat scanted on Roke. Often Ged and Petchvari and his little son Eoweth went out into the channels and lagoons, sailing or rowing one boat or another, till Ged was a fair sailor, and the friendship between him and Petchvari was a settled thing. Along in late autumn, the boatmaker's son fell sick. The mother sent for the witchwoman of Teskyle, who was a good hand at healing, and all seemed well for a day or two, and then, in the middle of a stormy night, came Petchvari, hammering at Ged's door, begging him to come save the child. Ged ran down to the boat with him, and they rowed in all haste through dark and rain to the boatmaker's house, and there Ged saw the child on his pallet bed, and the mother crouching silent beside him, and the witchwoman making a smoke of corley root and singing the Negian chant, which was the best healing she had, but she whispered to Ged,
"Lord wizard, I think this fever is the red fever, and the child will die of it tonight."
When Ged knelt and put his hands on the child, he thought the same, and he drew back a moment. In the latter months of his own long sickness, the master herbal had taught him much of the healer's lore, and the first lesson and the last of all that lore was this. Heal the wound and cure the illness, but let the dying spirit go. The mother saw his movement and the meaning of it and cried out aloud in despair. Petrieri stooped down by her, saying,
"The Lord Sparrowhawk will save him, wife. No need to cry. He's here now. He can do it."
Hearing the mother's wail and seeing the trust Petrieri had in him, Ged did not know how he could disappoint them. He mistrusted his own judgment and thought perhaps the child might be saved if the fever could be brought down, and he said, I'll do my best, Petrieri." He set to bathing the little boy with cold rainwater that they brought new-fallen from out of doors, and he began to say one of the spells of fever stay. The spell took no hold and made no hole, and suddenly he thought the child was dying in his arms. Summoning his power all at once, and with no thought for himself, he sent his spirit out after the child's spirit to bring it back home. He called the child's name, "Eolith." Thinking some faint answer came in his inward hearing, he pursued, calling once more, "Eolith!" Then he saw the little boy running fast and far ahead of him down a dark slope, the side of some vast hill. There was no sound. The stars above the hill were no stars his eyes had ever seen. Yet he knew the constellations by name, the sheaf, the door, the one who turns, the tree. They were those stars that do not set, that are not paled by the coming of any day. He had followed the dying child too far. Knowing this, he found himself alone on the dark hillside. And it was hard to turn back. It was very hard. He turned slowly. And slowly he set one foot forward to climb back up the hill, and then the other. Step by step he went, each step willed, and each step was harder than the last. And the stars did not move. No wind blew over the dry, steep ground. In all the vast kingdom of the darkness, only he moved, slowly, climbing. He came to the top of the hill and saw the low wall of stone, the low wall of stone, the low wounds there. But across the wall, facing him, there was a shadow. The shadow did not have the shape of man or beast. It was shapeless, scarcely to be seen. But it whispered at him, though there were no words in its whispering, and it reached out towards him, and it stood on the side of the living, and he on the side of the dead. Either he must go down the hill into the desert lands and lightless cities of the dead, or he must step across the wall back into life, where the formless evil thing waited for him. His spirit staff was in his hand, and he raised it high, and with that motion strength came into him as he made to leap the low wall of stone straight at the shadow. The staff burned suddenly white, a blinding light in that dim place. He leaped, felt himself fall, and saw no more. Now, what Petrieri and his wife and the witch saw was this. The young wizard had stopped midway in his spell and held the child a while motionless. Then he had laid little Eolith gently down on the pallet and had risen and stood silent, staff in hand. And all at once he raised the staff high, and it blazed with white fire as if he held the lightning bolt in his grip, and all the household things in the hut leaped out strange and vivid in that momentary fire, and when their eyes were clear from the dazzlement, they saw the young man lying huddled forward on the earthen floor beside the pallet where the child lay dead. To Petrieri it seemed that the wizard also was dead. His wife wept, but he was utterly bewildered. But the witch had some hearsay knowledge concerning magery and the ways a true wizard may go, and she saw to it that Ged, cold and lifeless as he lay, was not treated as a dead man, but as one sick or tranced. He was carried home, and an old woman was left to watch and see whether he slept to wake or slept forever. The little Otak was hiding in the rafters of the house, as it did when strangers entered. And there it stayed while the rain beat on the walls, and the fire sank down in the night, wearing slowly along, left the old woman nodding beside the hearth pit. Then the Otak crept down and came to Ged, where he lay stretched stiff and still upon the bed. It began to lick his hands and wrists long and patiently with its dry, leaf-brown tongue. Crouching beside his head, it licked his temple, his scarred cheek, and softly his closed eyes. And very slowly, under that soft touch, Ged roused. He woke, not knowing where he had been or where he was or what was the faint gray light in the air about him, which was the light of dawn coming to the world. And then the Otak curled up near his shoulder as usual and went to sleep. Later, when Ged thought back upon that night, he knew that had none touched him when he lay thus, spirit lost, had none called him back in some way, he might have been lost for good. It was only the dumb, instinctive wisdom of the beast who licks his hurt companion to comfort him. And yet, in that wisdom, Ged saw something akin to his own power, something that went as deep as wizardry. From that time forth, he believed that the wise man is one who never sets himself apart from other living things, whether they have speech or not. And in later years, he strove long to learn what can be learned in silence, from the eyes of animals, the flight of birds, the great, slow gestures of trees. He had now made unscathed, for the first time, that crossing over and return which only a wizard can make with open eyes, and which not the greatest mage can make without risk. But he had returned to a grief and a fear. The grief was for his friend Petrivari, the fear was for himself. He knew now why the archmage had feared to send him forth, and what had darkened and clouded even the mage's foreseeing of his future. For it was darkness itself that had awaited him. The unnamed thing, the being that did not belong in the world, the shadow he had loosed or made. In spirit, at the boundary wall between death and life, it had waited for him these long years. It had found him there at last, and it would be on his track now, seeking to draw near to him, to take his strength into itself and suck up his life and clothe itself in his flesh. Soon after, he dreamed of the thing like a bear with no head or face. He thought it went fumbling about the walls of the house, searching for the door. Such a dream he had not dreamed since the healing of the wounds the thing had given him. And when he woke, he was weak and cold, and the scars on his face and shoulder drew and ached. And now began a bad time. When he dreamed of the shadow, or so much as thought of it, he felt always that same cold dread. Sense and power drained out of him, leaving him stupid and astray. He raged at his cowardice, but that did no good. He sought for some protection, but there was none. The thing was not flesh, not alive, not spirit, unnamed, having no being, but what he himself had given it, a terrible power outside the laws of the sunlit world. And all he knew of it was that it was drawn to him and would try to work its will through him, being his creature. But in what form it could come, having no real form of its own as yet, and how it would come, and when it would come, this he did not know. He set up what barriers of sorcery he could about his house and about the isle where he lived. Such spell walls must be ever renewed, and soon he saw that if he spent all his strength on these defenses, he would be of no use to the islanders. What could he do between two enemies if a dragon came from Pendor? And again he dreamed. But this time in the dream, the shadow was inside his house, beside the door, reaching out to him through the darkness and whispering words he did not understand. And he woke in terror and sent the werelight flaming through the air, lighting every corner of the little house till he saw no shadow anywhere. And then he put wood on the coals of his fire pit and sat in the firelight, hearing the autumn wind fingering at the thatch roof and whining in the great bare trees above. And he pondered long. An old anger had awakened in his heart. He would not suffer this helpless waiting, this sitting trapped on a little island, muttering useless spells of lock and ward. Yet he could not simply flee the trap. To do so, would be to break his trust with the islanders and to leave them to the imminent dragon undefended. There was but one way to take. The next morning he went down among the fishermen in the principal moorage of Low Torning, and finding the head isleman there, said to him, "I must leave this place. I am in danger, and I put you in danger, so I must go. Therefore I ask your leave to go out and do away with the dragons on Pendor, so that my task for you will be finished, and I may leave freely. Or if I fail, I should fail also when they come here, and that is better known now than later." The Isleman stared at him all drop-jawed. "Lord Sparrowhawk," he said, there are 9 dragons out there. 8 are still young, they say. But the old one! I tell you, I must go from here. I ask your leave to rid you of the dragon peril first, if I can do so. "Well, as you will, sir," the Isleman said gloomily. All that listened there thought this a folly or a crazy courage in their young wizard, and with sullen faces they saw him go, expecting no news of him again. Some hinted that he meant merely to sail back by Husk to the inmost sea, leaving them in the lurch. Others, among them Petchfairy, held that he had gone mad and sought death. For 4 generations of men, all ships had set their course to keep far from the shores of Pendor Island. No mage had ever come to do combat with the dragon there, for the island was on no traveled sea road, and its lords had been pirates, slave takers, war makers, hated by all that dwelt in the southwest parts of Earthsea, and for this reason none had sought to revenge the lord of Pendor after the dragon came suddenly out of the west upon him, and his men where they sat feasting in the tower, and smothered them with the flames of his mouth, and drove all the townsfolk screaming into the sea. Unavenged, Pendor had been left to the dragon, with all its bones and towers and jewels stolen from long-dead princes of the coasts of Paln and Husk. All this Ged knew well, and more, for ever since he came to Low Torning he had held in mind and pondered over all he had ever learned of dragons. As he guided his small boat westward, not rowing now, nor using the seaman's skill Petchfairy had taught him, but sailing wizardly with the mage wind in his sail, and a spell set on prow and keel to keep them true, he watched to see the dead isle rise on the rim of the sea. Speed he wanted, and therefore used the mage wind, for he feared what was behind him more than what was before him. But as the day passed, his impatience turned from fear to a kind of glad fierceness. At least he sought this danger of his own will, and the nearer he came to it, the more sure he was that for this time at least, for this hour perhaps before his death, he was free. The shadow dared not follow him into a dragon's jaws. The waves ran white-tipped on the gray sea, and gray clouds streamed overhead on the north wind, and he went west with the quick mage wind in his sail, and came in sight of the rocks of Pendor, the still streets of the town, and the gutted falling towers. At the entrance of the harbor, a shallow crescent bay, he let the wind spell drop and stilled his little boat so it lay rocking on the waves. Then he summoned the dragon.
"Usurper of Pendor! Come, defend your hoard!"
His voice fell short at the sound of breakers beating on the ashen shores, but dragons have keen ears. And presently one flitted up from some roofless ruin of the town like a vast black bat, thin-winged and spiny-backed, and circling into the north wind came flying towards Ged. His heart swelled at the sight of the creature that was a myth to his people, and he laughed and he shouted, "Go tell the old one to come, you windworm!" For this was one of the young dragons, spawned there years ago by a she-dragon from the West Reach, who had set her clutch of great leathern eggs, as they say she-dragons will, in some sunny broken room of the tower, and had flown away again, leaving the old dragon of Pendor to watch the young when they crawled like baneful lizards from the shell. The young dragon made no answer. He was not large of his kind, maybe the length of a 40-oared ship, and was worm-thin for all the reach of his black membranous wings. He had not got his growth yet, nor his voice, nor any dragon cunning. Straight at Ged in the small rocking boat he came, opening his long-toothed jaws as he slid down arrowy from the air, so that all Ged had to do was bind his wings and limbs stiff with one sharp spell and send him thus hurtling aside into the sea like a stone falling, boom, and the gray sea closed over him. 2 dragons like the first rose from the base of the highest tower.
Even as the first one, they came driving straight at Ged, and even so, he caught both, hurled both down, and drowned them, and he had not yet lifted up his wizard staff.
Now, after a little time, there came three against him from the island. One of these was much greater, and fire spewed curling from its jaws. Two came flying at him, rattling their wings, but the big one came circling from behind, very swift, to burn him and his boat with its breath of fire. No binding spell would catch all three, because two came from north and one from south. And in the instant that he saw this, Ged worked a spell of changing, and between one breath and the next, flew up from his boat in dragon form. Spreading broad wings and reaching talons out, he met the two head-on, withering them with fire, and then turned to the third, who was larger than he and armed also with fire, and on the wind, over the gray waves, they doubled, snapped, swooped, lunged, till smoke roiled about them, red-lit by the glare of their fiery mouths. Ged flew suddenly upward, and the other pursued below him. In mid-flight, the dragon Ged raised wings, stopped, and stooped. As the hawk stoops, talons outstretched downward, striking and bearing the other down by neck and flank. The black wings flurried and black dragon blood dropped in thick drops into the sea. The Pendor dragon tore free and flew low and lamely to the island where it hid, crawling into some well or cavern in the ruined town. At once Ged took his form and place again on the boat, for it was most perilous to keep that dragon shape longer than need demanded. His hands were black with the scalding worm blood, and he was scorched about the head with fire. But this was no matter now. He waited only till he had his breath back, and then called,
"Six I have seen! Six! Five slain, nine are told of! Come out, worms!"
No creature moved. Nor voice spoke for a long while on the island, but only the waves beat loudly on the shore. And then Ged was aware that the highest tower slowly changed its shape, bulging out on one side as if it grew an arm. He feared dragon magic, for old dragons are very powerful and guileful in a sorcery like, in a sorcery like, in a sorcery, and unlike the sorcery of men. But a moment more and he saw this was no trick of the dragon, but of his own eyes. What he had taken for a part of the tower was the shoulder of the dragon of Pendor, as he uncurled his bulk and lifted himself slowly up. When he was all afoot, his scaled head, spike-crowned and triple-tongued, rose higher than the broken tower's height, and his taloned forefeet rested on the rubble of the town below. His scales were gray-black, catching the daylight like broken stone. Lean as a hound he was, and huge as a hill. Ged stared in awe. There was no song or tale could prepare the mind for this sight. Almost he stared into the dragon's eyes and was caught. For one cannot look into a dragon's eyes. He glanced away from the oily green gaze that watched him and held up before him his staff that looked now like a splinter, like a twig.
"Eight sons I had, little wizard," said the great dry voice of the dragon. "Five died. One dies. Enough! You will not win my hoard by killing them."
"I do not want your hoard!"
The yellow smoke hissed from the dragon's nostrils. That was his laughter.
"Would you not like to come ashore and look at it, little wizard? It is worth looking at."
"No, dragon! No, no!"
The kinship of dragons is with wind and fire. And they do not fight willingly over the sea. That had been Ged's advantage so far, and he kept it. But the strip of seawater between him and the great gray talons didn't seem much of an advantage anymore. And it was hard not to look into the green, watching eyes.
"You are very young, wizard," the dragon said. "I did not know men came so young into their power."
He spoke, as did Ged, in the old speech, for that is the tongue of dragons still.
Although the use of old speech binds a man to truth, this is not so with dragons. It is their own language, and they can lie in it, twisting the true words to false ends, catching the unwary hearer in a maze of mirror words, each of which reflects the truth, and none of which leads anywhere. So Ged had been warned often, and when the dragon spoke, he listened with an untrustful ear, all his doubts ready, but the words seemed plain and clear.
"Is it to ask my help that you have come here, little wizard?"
"No, no, dragon, no."
"Yet I could help you. You will need help soon against that which hunts you in the dark."
Ged stood dumb.
"What is it that hunts you? Name it to me."
"If I could name it..."
And Ged stopped himself. Yellow smoke curled above the dragon's long head from the nostrils that were two round pits of fire.
"If you could name it, you could master it. Maybe, little wizard, maybe I could tell you its name when I see it close by. And it will come close. If you wait about my isle, it will come wherever you come. If you do not want it to come close, you must run and run and keep running from it, and yet it will follow you. Would you like to know its name?"
Ged stood silent again. How the dragon knew of the shadow he had loosed, he could not guess. Now, how it might know the shadow's name. The archmage had said that the shadow had no name, yet dragons have their own wisdom, and they are an older race than man. Few men can guess what a dragon knows and how he knows it, and those few, they are the dragon lords. To Ged, only one thing was sure, that though the dragon might well be speaking truth, though he might indeed be able to tell Ged the nature and name of the shadow thing and so give him power over it, even so, even if he spoke truth, he did so wholly for his own ends.
"It is very seldom," the young man said at last, "that dragons ask to do men favors."
"But it is very common for cats to play with mice before they kill them."
"But I did not come here to play or to be played with. I came to strike a bargain with you."
Like a sword in sharpness, but five times the length of any sword, the point of the dragon's tail arched up scorpion-wise over his mailed back above the tower. Dryly he spoke.
"I strike no bargains. I take. What have you to offer that I cannot take from you when I like?"
"Safety? Your safety? Swear that you will never fly eastward of Pendor, and I will swear to leave you unharmed."
A grating sound came from the dragon's throat like the noise of an avalanche far off, stones falling among mountains. Fire danced along his three-forked tongue. He raised himself higher, looming over the ruins.
"You offer me safety? You threaten me? With what?"
"With your name, Yavod!"
Ged's voice shook as he spoke the name, yet he spoke it clear and loud, and the sound of it the old dragon held still, utterly still. A minute went by and another, and then Ged, standing there in his rocking chip of a boat, smiled. He had staked this venture and his life on a guess drawn from old histories of dragon lore learned on Roke. A guess that this dragon of Pendor was the same that had spoiled the west of Oskil in the days of Alfarin and Mored, and had been driven from Oskil by a wizard, Elt, wise in names. And the guess had held.
We are a match, Gibbard! You have the strength, I have your name. Will you bargain? Still the dragon made no reply. Many years had the dragon sprawled on the island where golden breastplates and emeralds lay scattered among dust and bricks and bones. He had watched his black lizard brood play among crumbling houses and try their wings from the cliffs. He had slept long in the sun, unwaked by voice or sail. He had grown old. It was hard now to stir, to face this mage lad, this frail enemy, at the sight of whose staff Yavod, the old dragon, winced.
You may choose 9 stones from my hoard,
he said at last, his voice hissing and whining in his long jaws.
The best. Take your choice. Then go.
I do not want your stones, Yavod.
Where is men's greed gone? Men loved bright stones in the old days in the north. I know what it is you want, wizard. I, too, can offer you safety. For I know what can save you. I know what alone can save you. There is a horror follows you. I will tell you its name.
Ged's heart leaped in him, and he clutched his staff, standing as still as the dragon stood. He fought a moment with sudden, startling hope. It was not his own life that he bargained for. One mastery, and only one, could he hold over the dragon. He set hope aside and did what he must do.
That is not what I ask for, Yavod!
When he spoke the dragon's name, it was as if he held the huge being on a fine, thin leash, tightening it on his throat. He could feel the ancient malice and experience of men in the dragon's gaze that rested on him, and he could see the steel talons, each as long as a man's forearm, and the stone-hard hide, and the withering fire that lurked in the dragon's throat, and yet always the leash tightened, and he spoke again,
Yavod! Swear by your name that you and your sons will never come to the archipelago.
Flames broke suddenly bright and loud from the dragon's jaws, and he said,
I swear it by my name.
Silence lay over the isle then, and Yavod lowered his great head. And when he raised it again and looked, the wizard was gone, and the sail of the boat was a white flick on the waves eastward, heading towards the fat, bejeweled islands of the inner seas. And then, in a rage, the old dragon of Pendor rose, breaking the tower with the writhing of his body and beating his wings that spanned the whole width of the ruined town. But his oath held him, and he did not fly, then or ever, to the archipelago.
Chapter 6. Hunted. As soon as Pendor had sunk under the sea rim behind him, Ged, looking eastward, felt the fear of the shadow come into his heart again, and it was hard to turn from the bright danger of the dragons to that formless, hopeless horror. He let the mage wind drop and sailed on with the world's wind, for there was no desire for speed in him now. He had no clear plan even of what he should do. He must run, as the dragon had said, but where? To Roke? He thought, since there, at least, he was protected, and might find counsel among the wise. First, however, he must come to Lough Torning once more, and tell his tale to the Islemen. When word went out that he had returned, 5 days from his setting forth, they and half the people of the township came rowing and running to gather round him, and stare at him and listen. He told his tale, and one man said, But who saw this wonder of dragons slain, and dragons baffled. What if he...
Be still, the head Isleman said roughly, for he knew, as did most of them, that a wizard may have subtle ways of telling the truth, and may keep the truth to himself, but that if he says a thing, the thing is as he says, for that is his mastery. So they wondered and began to feel that their fear was lifted from them, and then they began to rejoice. They pressed round their young wizard and asked for the tale again. More islanders came and asked for it again. By nightfall he no longer had to tell it. They could do it for him. Better. Already the village chanters had fitted it to an old tune and were singing the Song of the Sparrowhawk.
Bonfires were burning not only on the Isles of Lothorning, but in townships to the south and east. Fishermen shouted the news from boat to boat, from isle to isle. It went, "Evil is averted! The dragons will never come from Pendor!" That night, that one night, was joyous for Ged. No shadow could come near him through the brightness of those fires of thanksgiving that burned on every hill and beach, through the circles of laughing dancers that ringed him about, singing his praise, swinging their torches in the gusty autumn night, so that sparks rose thick and bright and brief upon the wind. The next day he met with Petrary, who said,
"I did not know you were so mighty, my lord."
There was fear in that, because he had dared make Ged his friend, but there was reproach in it also. Ged had not saved a little child, though he had slain dragons. After that, Ged felt afresh the unease and impatience that had driven him to Pendor, and drove him now from Lothorning. The next day, though they would have kept him gladly the rest of his life to praise and boast of, he left the house on the hill, with no baggage but his books, his staff, and the Otak riding on his shoulder. He went in a rowboat with a couple of young fishermen of Lothorning who wanted the honor of being his boatmen. Always, as they rowed on among the craft that crowd the eastern channels of the Ninety Isles, under the windows and balconies of houses that lean out over the water, past the wharves of Nesh, the rainy pastures of Drumgun, the malodorous oil sheds of Giath, word of his deed had gone ahead of him. They whistled the song of the sparrowhawk as he went by. They vied to have him spend the night and then tell his dragon tale. And when at last he came to Surd, the ship's master of whom he asked passage out to Roke, bowed as he answered,
"A privilege to me, Lord Wizard, and an honor to my ship."
So Ged turned his back on the Ninety Isles. But even as the ship turned from Surd inner port and raised sail, a wind came up hard from the east against her. It was strange, for the wintry sky was clear and the weather had seemed settled mild that morning. It was only 30 miles from Surd to Roke, and they sailed on. And when the wind still rose, they still sailed on. The little ship, like most traders of the inmost sea, bore the high fore-and-aft sail that can be turned to catch a headwind, and her master was a handy seaman, proud of his skill. So, tacking now north, now south, they worked eastward. Clouds and rain came up on the wind, which veered and gusted so wildly that there was considerable danger of the ship jibing. "Lord Sparrowhawk," said the ship's master to the young man, whom he had beside him in the place of honor in the stern, though small dignity could be kept up under that wind and rain that wet them all to a miserable sleekness in their sodden cloaks. "Lord Sparrowhawk, might you say a word to this wind, maybe?" "How near are we to Roke?"
Better than halfway, but we've made no headway at all this past hour, sir."
Ged spoke to the wind. It blew less hard, and for a while they went on fairly enough. And then sudden great gusts came whistling out of the south, and meeting these, they were driven back westward again. The clouds broke and boiled in the sky, and the ship's master roared out ragefully,
"This fool's gale blows always at once! Only a mage wind will get us through this weather, lord!"
Ged looked glum at that, but the ship and her men were in danger for him, so he raised up the mage wind into her sail. At once the ship began to cleave straight to the east, and the ship's master began to look cheerful again. But little by little, though Ged kept up the spell, the mage wind slackened, growing feebler, until the ship seemed to hang still on the waves for a minute, her sail drooping amid all the tumult of the rain and gale, and then with a thunder crack the boom came swinging round, and she jibed and jumped northward like a scared cat. Ged grabbed hold of a stanchion, for she lay almost over on her side, and shouted out, "Turn back to Surd, master!" The master cursed and shouted that he would not.
"A wizard aboard, and I the best seaman of the trade, and this the handiest ship I ever sailed! Turn back!"
Then the ship, turning again almost as if a whirlpool had caught her keel, he too grabbed hold of the stern post to keep aboard, and Ged said to him, "Leave me at Surd, and sail where you like. It's not against your ship this wind blows, but against me!"
"Against you, a wizard of Roke? Have you never heard of the Roke wind, master?" "Aye, that keeps off evil powers from the Isle of the Wise. But what has that to do with you, a dragon tamer?" "That is between me and my shadow,"
Ged answered shortly, as a wizard will, and he said no more as they went swiftly with a steady wind and under clearing skies back over the sea to Surd. There was a heaviness and a dread in his heart as he went up from the wharves of Surd. The days were shortening into winter, and dusk came soon. With dusk, Ged's uneasiness always grew, and now the turning of each street seemed a threat to him, and he had to steel himself not to keep looking back over his shoulder at what might be coming behind him. He went to the Sea House of Surd, where travelers and merchants ate together of good fare provided by the township, and might sleep in the long, raftered hall. Such is the hospitality of the thriving islands of the Inmost Sea. He saved a bit of meat from his dinner, and by the fire pit afterward he coaxed the Otak out of the fold of his hood where it had cowered all that day, and tried to get it to eat, petting it and whispering to it, "Hoig, hoig, 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 shh, little one, silent one." But it would not eat, and crept into his pocket to hide. By that, by his own dull uncertainty, by the very look of the darkness in the corners of the great room, he knew that the shadow was not far from him. No one in this place knew him. They were travelers from other isles who had not heard the song of the sparrowhawk, and none spoke to him. He chose a pallet at last and lay down, but all night long he lay with open eyes there in the raftered hall among the sleep of strangers, and all night he tried to choose his way, to plan where he should go and what he should do. But each choice, each plan was blocked by a foreboding of doom. Across each way he might go lay the shadow. Only Roke was clear of it, and to Roke he could not go, forbidden by the high and woven ancient spells that kept the perilous island safe. That the Roke wind had risen against him was proof. The thing that hunted him must be very close upon him now. That thing was bodiless, blind to sunlight, a creature of a lightless, placeless, timeless realm. It must grope after him through the days and across the seas of the sunlit world, and could take visible shape only in dream and darkness. It had as yet no substance or being that the light of the sun would shine on. And so it is sung in the deed of Hode. Daybreak makes all earth and sea, from shadow brings forth form, driving dream to the dark kingdom. But if once the shadow caught up with Ged, it could draw his power out of him, and take from him the very weight and warmth and life of his body, and the will that moved him. That was the doom he saw lying ahead on every road, and he knew that he might be tricked toward that doom, for the shadow, growing stronger always as it was nearer him, might even now have strength enough to put evil powers or evil men to its own use, showing him false portents, or speaking with a stranger's voice, and for all he knew, in one of these men who slept in this corner or that of the raftered hall of the Sea House tonight, the dark thing lurked, finding a foothold in a dark soul, and there, waiting and watching Ged and feeding, even now, on his weakness, on his uncertainty, on his fear. It was past bearing. He must trust to chance and run wherever chance took him. At the first cold hint of dawn, he got up and went in haste, under the dimming stars, down to the wharves of Surd, resolved only to take the first ship outward bound that would have him. A galley was loading turby oil. She was to sail at sunrise, bound for Havnor Greatport. Ged asked passage of her master. A wizard's staff is passport, and payment on most ships. They took him aboard willingly, and within that hour the ship set forth. Ged's spirits lifted with the first lifting of the 40 long oars, and the drum beat that kept the stroke made a brave music to him. And yet, he did not know what he would do in Havnor, or where he would run from there. Northward was as good as any direction. He was a northerner himself. Maybe he would find some ship to take him on to Gaunt from Havnor, and he might see Ogion again. Or he might find some ship going far out into the reaches, so far the shadow would lose him and give up the hunt. Beyond such vague ideas as these, there was no plan in his head, and he saw no one course that he must follow. Only he must run. Those 40 oars carried the ship over 150 miles of wintry sea before sunset of the second day out from Surd. They came into port at Orimi on the east shore of the great land Husk, for these trade galleys of the Inmost Sea keep to the coasts and lie overnight in harbor whenever they can. Ged went ashore, for it was still daylight, and he roamed the steep streets of the port town, aimless and brooding. Orimi is an old town, built heavily of stone and brick, walled against the lawless lords of the interior of Husk Island. The warehouses on the docks are more like forts, and the merchants' houses are towered and fortified. Yet to Ged, wandering through the streets, those ponderous mansions seemed like veils, behind which lay an empty dark, and people who passed him, intent on their business, seemed not real men, but voiceless shadows of men. As the sun set, he came down to the wharves again, and even there, in the broad red light and wind of the day's end, sea and land alike to him seemed dim and silent.
"Where are you bound, Lord Wizard?"
So one hailed him suddenly from behind. Turning, he saw a man dressed in gray who carried a staff of heavy wood that was not a wizard's staff. The stranger's face was hidden by his hood from the red light, but his hood from the red light, but his hood from the... Ged felt the unseen eyes meet his. Starting back, he raised his own yew staff between him and the stranger. Mildly, the man asked,
What do you fear?
What follows behind me?
So, but I'm not your shadow.
Ged stood silent. He knew that indeed this man, whatever he was not what he feared. He was no shadow or ghost or gebbeth creature. Amidst the dry silence and shadowiness that had come over the world, he even kept a voice in some solidity. He put back his hood now. He had a strange, seamed, bald head, a lined face. Though age had not sounded in his voice, he looked to be an old man.
"I do not know you," said the man in gray. "Yet I think perhaps we do not meet by chance. I heard a tale once of a young man, a scarred man, who won through darkness to great dominion, even to kingship. I do not know if that is your tale, but I will tell you this. Go to the court of the Terranon if you need a sword to fight shadows with. A staff of yew wood will not serve your need."
Hope and mistrust struggled in Ged's mind as he listened. A wizardly man soon learns that few indeed of his meetings are chance ones, be they for good or for ill.
"In what land is the court of the Terranon?"
"In Oskil."
At the sound of that name, Ged saw for a moment, by a trick of memory, a black raven on green grass who looked up at him sidelong with an eye like polished stone and spoke, but the words were forgotten.
"That land has something of a dark name," Ged said, looking over at the man in gray, trying to judge what kind of man he was.
There was a manner about him that hinted of the sorcerer, even of the wizard, and yet, boldly as he spoke to Ged, there was a queer, beaten look about him, the look almost of a sick man or a prisoner or a slave.
"You are from Rok," he answered. "The wizards of Rok give a dark name to wizardries other than their own."
"What man are you?"
"A traveler, a trader's agent from Oskil. I am here on business," said the man in gray.
And when Ged asked him no more, he quietly bade the young man good night and went off up the narrow step street above the quays.
Ged turned, irresolute whether to heed this sign or not, and looked to the north.
The red light was dying out fast from the hills and from the windy sea. Gray dusk came, and on its heels the night. Ged went in sudden decision and haste along the quays to a fisherman who was folding his nets down in his dory and hailed him.
Hello, do you know any ship in this port bound north to Semel or the Enlades?"
"The long ship yonder's from Oskil, and she might be stopping at the Enlades."
In the same haste, Ged went on to the great ship the fisherman had pointed to, a long ship of 60 oars, gaunt as a snake, her high-bent prow carven and inlaid with disks of loto shell, her oarport covers painted red with the rune Sifil sketched on each in black. A grim, swift ship she looked, and all in sea trim, with all her crew aboard. Ged sought out the ship's master and asked passage to Oskil of him.
"Can you pray? I have some skill with winds."
I am a weather worker myself. You have nothing to give? No money?"
In low torning, the Isleman had paid Ged as best they could with the ivory pieces used by traders in the archipelago. He would take only 10 pieces, though they wanted to give him more. He offered these now to the Oskilian, but he shook his head.
"We do not use those counters. If you have nothing to pay, I have no place aboard for you."
"Do you need arms? I have rowed in a galley."
Aye, we're short two men. Find your bench, then, said the ship's master, and paid him no more heed.
So, laying his staff and his bag of books under the rower's bench, Ged became for 10 bitter days of winter an oarsman of that northern ship. They left Oromi at daybreak, and that day Ged thought he could never keep up his work. His left arm was somewhat lamed by the old wounds in his shoulder, and all his rowing in the channels about Lotorning had not trained him for the relentless pull and pull and pull at the long galley oar to the beat of the drum. Each stint at the oars was of 2 or 3 hours, and then a second shift of oarsmen took the benches, but the time of rest seemed only long enough for all Ged's muscles to stiffen, and then it was back to the oars. And the second day of it was worse. But after that he hardened to the labor and got on well enough. There was no such comradeship among this crew as he had found aboard Shadow when he first went to Roke. The crewmen of Andradean and Gaunt's ships are partners in the trade, working together for a common profit, whereas traders of Oskill use slaves and bondsmen or hire men to row, paying them with small coins of gold. Gold is a great thing in Oskill. But it is not a source of good fellowship there, or amongst the dragons, who also prize it highly. Since half of this crew were bondsmen forced to work, the ship's officers were slave masters, and harsh ones. They never laid their whips on the back of an oarsman who worked for pay or passage, but there will not be much friendliness in a crew of whom some are whipped and others are not. Ged's fellows said little to one another, and less to him. They were mostly men from Oskill, speaking not the Hardic tongue of the archipelago, but a dialect of their own, and they were dour men, pale-skinned, with black, drooping mustaches and lank hair. Cheleb, the Red One, was Ged's name among them. Though they knew he was a wizard, they showed him no regard, but rather a kind of cautious spitefulness, and he himself was in no mood for making friends. Even on his bench, caught up in the mighty rhythm of the rowing, one oarsman among 60 in a ship racing over void gray seas, he felt himself exposed and defenseless. And when they came into strange ports at nightfall and he rolled himself in his cloak to sleep, weary as he was, he would dream, wake, dream again, evil dreams that he could not recall waking, though they seemed to hang about the ship and the men of the ship, so that he mistrusted each one of them. All the Oskillian freemen wore a long knife at the hip, and one day, as his oar shift shared their noon meal, one of these men asked Ged, "Are you a slave or oathbreaker, Cheleb?" "Neither." "Why no knife, then? Afraid to fight?" said the man, Skior, jeering. No, I'm not afraid to fight." "Your little dog fight for you?" "Otak," said another who listened. "No dog, that is Otak," and he said something in Oskillian that made Skior scowl and turn away. Just as he turned, Ged saw a change in his face, a slurring and shifting of the features, as if for a moment something had changed him, used him, looking out through his eyes sidelong at Ged. Yet the next minute, Ged saw him full face, and he looked as usual, so that Ged told himself that what he had seen was his own fear, his own dread reflected in the other's eyes. But that night, as they lay in port in Essen, he dreamed, and Skir walked in his dream. Afterwards he avoided the man as best he could, and it seemed also that Skir kept away from him, and no more words passed between them. The snow-crowned mountains of Havnor sank away behind them southward, blurred by the mists of early winter. They rode on past the mouth of the Sea of Ea, where long ago Alfarin was drowned, and past the Enlades. They lay 2 days in port at Barilla, the City of Ivory, white above its bay in the west of myth-haunted Enlad. At all ports they came to, the crewmen were kept aboard the ship and set no foot on land. And then as a red sun rose, they rode out on the Oskill Sea into the northeast winds that blow unhindered from the islandless vastness of the North Reach. Through that bitter sea they brought their cargo safe, coming the second day out of Barilla into port at Neshwum, the trade city of eastern Oskill. Ged saw a low coast lashed by rainy wind, a gray town crouching behind the long stone breakwaters that made its harbor, and behind the town, treeless hills under a snow-darkened sky. They had come far from the sunlight of the inmost sea. Longshoremen of the Sea Guild of Neshwum came aboard to unload the cargo. Gold, silver, jewelry, fine silks and southern tapestries, such precious stuff as the lords of Oskil hoard. And the freemen of the crew were dismissed. Ged stopped one of them to ask his way. Up until now, the distrust he felt of all of them had kept him from saying where he was bound, but now, afoot and alone in a strange land, he must ask for guidance. The man went on impatiently, saying he did not know, but Skjor, overhearing him, said, "The court of the Terranan, on the Keksemt Moors. I go that road." Skjor's was no company Ged would have chosen, but knowing neither the language nor the way, he had small choice. Nor did it much matter, he thought. He had not chosen to come here. He had been driven, and now was driven on. He pulled his hood up over his head, took up his staff and bag, and followed the Oskilian through the streets of the town and upward into the snowy hills. The little Otak would not ride on his shoulder, but hid in the pocket of his sheepskin tunic, under his cloak, as was its wont in cold weather. The hills stretched out into bleak, rolling moorlands as far as the eye could see, and they walked in silence, and the silence of winter lay on all the land. "How far?" Ged asked after they had gone some miles, seeing no sight of village or farm in any direction, and thinking that they had no food with them. Skjor turned his head a moment, pulling up his own hood, and said, "Not far." It was an ugly face, pale, coarse, and cruel. But Ged feared no man, though he might fear where such a man would guide him. He nodded, and they went on. Their road was only a scar through the waste of thin snow and leafless bushes. From time to time, other tracks crossed it or branched from it. Now that the chimney smoke of Neshem was hidden behind the hills in the darkening afternoon, there was no sign at all of what way they should go or had gone. Only the wind blew always from the east, and when they had walked for several hours, Ged thought he saw, away off on the hills in the northwest where their way tended, a tiny scratch against the sky, like a tooth, white. But the light of the short day was fading, and on the next rise of the road he could make out the thing, tower or tree or whatever, no more clearly than before. "Do we go there?" he asked, pointing. Skjor made no answer but plodded on, muffled in his coarse cloak with its peaked furred Oskilian hood. Ged strode on beside him. They had come far, and he was drowsy with the steady pace of their walking and with the long weariness of hard days and nights in the ship. And it began to seem to him that he had walked forever and would walk forever beside this silent being through a silent, darkening land. Caution and intention were dulled in him. He walked as in a long, long dream, going no place. The Otak stirred in his pocket, and a little vague fear also woke and stirred in his mind. He forced himself to speak. "Darkness comes and snow. How far, Skjor?" After a pause, the other answered without turning, "Not far." But his voice sounded not like a man's voice, but like a beast, hoarse and lipless, that tries to speak. Ged stopped. All around stretched empty hills in the late dusk light. Sparse snow whirled a little, falling. "Skjor!" he said, and the other halted and turned. There was no face under the peaked hood. Before Ged could speak spell or summon power, the Gebeth spoke, saying in its hoarse voice, "Ged!" Then the young man could work no transformation, but was locked in his true being and must face the Gebeth thus defenseless. Nor could he summon any help in this alien land where nothing and no one was known to him and would come at his call. He stood alone, with nothing between him and his enemy but the staff of Yewood in his right hand. The thing that had devoured Skjor's mind and possessed his flesh made the body take a step towards Ged, and the arms came groping out towards him. A rage of horror filled Ged, and he swung up and brought down his staff, whistling on the hood that hid the shadow face. Hood and cloak collapsed down nearly to the ground under that fierce blow as if there was nothing in them but wind, and then writhing and flapping, stood up again. The body of a Gebeth has been drained of true substance and is something like a shell or a vapor in the form of a man, an unreal flesh clothing the shadow which is real. So, jerking and billowing as if blown on the wind, the shadow spread its arms and came at Ged, trying to get hold of him as it had held him on Rok Nol, and if
it did, it would cast aside the husk of Skjork and enter into Ged, devouring him out from within, owning him, which was its whole desire. Ged struck at it again with his heavy smoking staff, beating it off, but it came again, and he struck again, and then dropped the staff that blazed and smoldered, burning his hand. He backed away, and then all at once turned and ran. He ran, and the Gebeth followed a pace behind him, unable to outrun him, yet never dropping behind. Ged never looked back. He ran through that vast dusk land where there was no hiding place. Once the Gebeth in its hoarse whistling voice called him again by name, Ged! But though it had taken his wizard's power thus, it had no power over his body's strength and could not make him stop. He ran. Night thickened about the hunter and the hunted, and snow blew fine across the path that Ged could no longer see. The pulse hammered in his eyes. The breath burned in his throat. He was no longer really running, but stumbling and staggering ahead. And yet the tireless pursuer seemed unable to catch up, coming always just behind him. It had begun to whisper and mumble at him, calling to him, and he knew that all his life that whispering had been in his ears, just under the threshold of hearing, but now he could hear it, and he must yield, he must give in, he must stop. Yet he labored on, struggling up a long, dim slope. He thought there was a light somewhere before him, and he thought he heard a voice in front of him, above him somewhere, calling, "Come, come!" He tried to answer, but he had no voice. The pale light grew certain, shining through a gateway straight before him. He could not see the walls, but he saw the gate. At the sight of it, he halted, and the Gebeth snatched at his cloak, fumbled at his sides, trying to catch hold of him from behind, and with the last strength in him, Ged plunged through that faint shining door. He tried to turn to shut it behind him again, against the Gebeth, but his legs would not hold him up. He staggered, reaching for support. Light swam and flashed in his eyes. He felt himself falling, and he felt himself caught even as he fell, but his mind, utterly spent, slid away into the dark.
Chapter 7. The Hawk's Flight. Ged woke, and for a long time he lay aware only that it was pleasant to wake, for he had not expected to wake again, and very pleasant to see light, the large, plain light of day all about him. He felt as if he were floating on that light or drifting in a boat on very quiet waters. At last he made out that he was in bed, but no such bed as he had ever slept in. It was set up on a frame held by four tall carven legs, and the mattresses were great silk sacks of down, which was why he thought he was floating. And over it all, a crimson canopy hung to keep out drafts. On two sides, the curtain was tied back, and Ged looked out at a room with walls of stone and floor of stone. Through three high windows he saw the moorland, bare and brown, snow-patched here and there in the mild sunlight of winter. The room must be high above the ground, for it looked a great way over the land. A coverlet of down-filled satin slid aside as Ged sat up, and he saw himself clothed in a tunic of silk and cloth of silver, like a lord. On a chair beside the bed, boots of glove leather and a cloak lined with Palawi fur were laid ready for him. He sat a while, calm and dull as one under an enchantment, and then stood up, reaching for his staff. But he had no staff. His right hand, though it had been salved and bound, was burned on palm and fingers, and now he felt the pain of it and the soreness of all his body. He stood without moving a while again, and then he whispered, not aloud and not hopefully, "Oeg, Oeg." The little, fierce, loyal creature, too, was gone. The little, silent soul that once had led him back from death's dominion. Had it still been with him last night when he ran? Was that last night? Was it many nights ago? He did not know. It was all dim and obscure in his mind, the Gebeth, the burning staff, the running, the whispering, the gate. None of it came back clearly to him. Nothing even now was clear. He whispered his pet's name once more. but without hope of answer, and tears rose in his eyes. A little bell rang somewhere far away, a second bell rang in a sweet jangle just outside the room, and a door opened behind him across the room, and a woman came in. "Welcome, Sparrowhawk," she said, smiling. She was young and tall, dressed in white and silver, with a net of silver crowning her hair that fell straight down like a fall of black water. Stiffly, Ged bowed.
"You don't remember me, I think."
"I remember you, lady?" He had never seen a beautiful woman dressed to match her beauty but once in his life. That lady of O, who had come with her lord to the Sun Return Festival at Roke. She had been like a slight, bright candle flame, but this woman was like the white new moon.
"I thought you would not," she said, smiling. "But forgetful as you may be, you are welcome here as an old friend."
What place is this? Ged asked, still stiff and slow-tongued. He found it hard to speak to her and hard to look away from her. The princely clothes he wore were strange to him. The stones he stood on were unfamiliar. The very air he breathed was alien. He was not himself, not the self he had been.
"This keep is called the Court of the Terranon. My lord, who is called Benderesk, is sovereign of this land from the edge of the Keksemp Moors north to the mountains of Os, and keeper of the precious stone called Terranon. As for myself, here in Oskil they call me Seret, silver in their language, and you, I know, are sometimes called Sparrowhawk, and were made wizard in the Isle of the Wise."
Ged looked down at his burned hand and said presently, "I do not know what I am. I had power once. I have lost it, I think."
"No, you have not lost it, or only to regain it tenfold. You are safe here from what drove you here, my friend. There are mighty walls about this tower, and not all of them are built of stone. And here you can rest, finding your strength again. Here you may also find a different strength, and a staff that will not burn to ashes in your hand. An evil way may lead to a good end, after all. Come with me now, let me show you our domain."
She spoke so sweetly that Ged hardly heard her words, moved by the promise of her voice alone. He followed her. His room was high up indeed in the tower that rose like a sharp tooth from its hilltop. Down winding stairs of marble he followed Seret, through rich rooms and halls, past high windows that looked north, west, south, east over the low brown hills that went on, houseless and treeless and changeless, clear to the sun-washed winter sky, and only far to the north small white peaks stood sharp against the blue, and southward one could guess the shining of the sea. Servants opened doors and stood aside for Ged and the lady. Pale, dour Oskilians they were all. She was light of skin, but unlike them, she spoke Hardic well, even it seemed to Ged with the accent of Gaunt. Later that day she brought him before her husband, Benderesk, lord of the Terranon. Thrice her age, bone-white, bone-thin, with clouded eyes, Lord Benderesk greeted Ged with grim, cold courtesy, bidding him stay as guest however long he would. And then he had little more to say, asking Ged nothing of his voyages, nor of the enemy that had hunted him here. Nor had the Lady Seret asked anything of these matters. If this was strange, it was only part of the strangeness of this place and of his presence in it. Ged's mind never seemed quite too clear. He could not see things plainly. He had come to this tower keep by chance, and yet the chance was all design. Or he had come by design, and yet all the design had merely chanced to come about. He had set out northward. A stranger in Orme had told him to seek help here. An Oskilian ship had been waiting for him. Skiorch had guided him. How much of this was the work of the shadow that hunted him, or was none of it? Had he and his hunter both been drawn here by some other power, he following that lure and the shadow following him, and seizing on Skiorch for its weapon when the moment came? Well, that must be it, for certainly the shadow was, as Seret had said, barred from the court of the Terranon, and he had felt no sign or threat of its lurking presence since he wakened in the tower. But what then had brought him here? for this was no place one came to by chance. Even in the dullness of his thoughts, he began to see that. No other stranger came to these gates. The tower stood aloof and remote, its back turned on the way to Neshum, that was the nearest town. Gnomes the nearest town. Man came to the keep. None left it. Its windows looked down on desolation. From these windows Ged looked out. As he kept by himself in his high tower room day after day, dull and heartsick and cold. It was always cold in the tower, for all the carpets and the tapestried hangings and the rich furred clothing and the broad marble fireplaces they had. It was a cold that got into the bone, into the marrow, and would not be dislodged. And in Ged's heart a cold shame settled also and would not be dislodged, as he thought always how he had faced his enemy and been defeated and had run. In his mind all the masters of Roke gathered, Genscher the Archmage frowning in their midst, and Nemerly was with them, and Ogion, and even the witch who had taught him his first spell, and all of them